such a long, long time. Then I thought about your kids, then I changed my mind. I knew I had to come back and help raise your kids and show you the way, the right way. I feel you're gotta live. You'll find all the happiness that mama gave you, that you will have to give. That's it.
You're listening to Earth Watch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And that concludes today's special celebration of the 85th anniversary of the birth of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We welcome your comments and insights with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's R-K-N-I-G-H-T @wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Okay, so MLK was 85 years ago. Hour of the Wolf was about 42, 43 years ago. And Alfred Bester was 100 years ago. Stay tuned. Thank you. Good morning. As mentioned, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And this will be an anniversary show, I guess. We do not know. It's January 16th. We do not know exactly what date Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf. Yeah, it would have been 42 years ago. But it was January. It was late January of 1972. And I took over the show about 2 years later. I was her co-host. She did the show 5 days a week because, well, she has 10 hours a week at minimum worth listening to. More than that, but 10 hours a week, 5 days a week, 2 hours a day is what we had. And I was her co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, and frequently engineer at other times. By the way, Margot will be here sometime in February to discuss her brand new book called Vampires Are Us. The actual pub date is March 1st, to be precise, but it'll be out a little bit earlier. So before we get to the show. Announcements. Okay, let's see. Well, unless you've got a TARDIS, I'm afraid you just missed the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading tonight, but I have no doubt it'll be a good one. Gordon Linsner recorded it for us, and we may very well hear it at some point in the near future. In a couple of weeks, the New York Review of Science Fiction, February 4th, to be precise, will be featuring D.T. Friedman and Nancy Hightower. If you were listening, I guess about 2-3 months ago now, D.T. Friedman, Dr. Danielle Friedman, was here and read a story that absolutely floored me. And next week, Nancy Hightower will be here, so you will learn more about her. So that will be at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, or Soho Art Space, as it is sometimes known. February 4th, Tuesday, doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. Donations are accepted for the event. Now, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art is also changing its nature. It's not just a place for events anymore. It is beginning, there's this sort of floating artisan market that has been going on for a while. I looked it up when the owner of the gallery, John Ordover, told me about it. And this floating gallery is going to be floating in to that very same space, Lala's Artisan Market, it is called. And they are going to be in that same space where we are on the first Tuesdays at 138 Sullivan Street on Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. So, for more information, go to Facebook and look up Gallery Lala. And that will tell you more. So I think that does the announcements. Alfred Bester. Alfie Bester is a person who was on this program several times in the 1970s. I should have looked up his exact particulars. In fact, I think, while as I'm talking to you, I'm going to dare to turn around. Pardon my mic move here. And seek it out. In December, as of December, Alfie turned 100 years old. He passed away some time back, but, you know, as they say, as you heard Robert Knight saying, and this is a phrase that I always hear people using nowadays, the anniversary of a person's birth. Come on, it's their birthday, you know, even if they've passed. That's their birthday. Okay, so let's see. Googling up Alfie Bester. Alfred Bester. Yeah, he died in 1987. One of my proudest moments on Hour of the Wolf and Barry Malzberg, who was a regular on this program every September until the show was moved to Wednesdays. When it was on Saturdays, he was our regular. One of my great joys on this program was Alfred coming in, and he was this dapper gent. He had been the head writer of The Shadow, as in, yes, who knows what lurks in the hearts and minds of men for any number of years. He is the person who on Green Lantern came up with, oh, whatever that poem was, you know, no hail or sleet will stop this Green Lantern from joining the planetary saviors, stuff like that. He was born December 18th, 1913, okay? So that gives us, you know, 100 years and a month. Died September 30th, 1987. I guess he was on this show about five or six times. There was one time that Alfie came in all sails to the wind, if you follow me. And he had been playing host to Brian W. Aldiss, one of the great science fiction writers. And it was a Saturday night after midnight. Mickey Waldman was on the air. Not that Alfie would know from, you know, a particular night. He just knew where the WBAI church, and yes, we were in a church in those days on East 62nd Street. He knew where it was. About 1 a.m., I was asleep in the balcony of the church. I fairly, well, lived there, I think is probably the term we are looking for. And he buzzes the door, bangs on the door, but mostly buzzes. Now, I'm asleep. Mickey Waldman, who was herself a well-versed in science fiction, although that was not the scope of her show, although she would occasionally just decide to read a story on Swan Song or The Next Swan, depending on what era this was in. This was probably Swan Song era. And she presses the buzzer, you know, plays a song, presses the buzzer, says, "Who is out there?" And Bester, referring to Brian W. Aldiss, says, "I've got the best science fiction writer in the world out here, and I want to put him on the radio." And Mickey, through the intercom, having no idea who was out there, could be any drunk on 62nd Street, and there were more than one, besides Alfie and Brian, said, "Well, the best science fiction writer in the world is Alfred Bester." He said, "I love you." And they came in, went on the air. I woke up in the balcony of the church, looked down into master control, cross Studio C into master control, which is a matter of about, 50 feet or so, and, you know, floor down. But this is church, remember, and I'm looking through the sanctuary. I can see it all. And I see, it's about 5 a.m., or 4:30, because I'm on the air at 5. And I take a look, and just leaving as I'm going on the air, are Alfred Bester and Brian W. Aldiss. And they're a bit more sober now. And they're saying, hey, wasn't that a great show, huh? Sigh. There are many people who will say that... I'm sorry, I have to go away and close a door because the noise leaking from WHCR is so great that I need to close the door. You can get in here if you need to, right?
I'm done, I'm out.
Oh, you're done. Thank you, Tony Ryan, for running this place. Take care. One of our few staff members left. Okay, so. Let me actually... Hey, Tony?
Yeah.
The door is closed, and it's still leaking into here. And I'm live, reading a short story.
It's near an end. The show's near an end.
Their show's near an end. It ends at 2:30. I know their schedule. I'm here every week. Anyway, sorry, folks. But I'm going to be reading you a short story, and I want there to be relative silence, if that can be attained. So, I was in a phone meeting tonight with people from the fledgling Museum of Science Fiction that is being put together in Washington, D.C. I am serving on a subcommittee of people discussing programming, but it's in early days. And one of the people said, you know, why weren't more movies made out of science fiction novels? And specifically, and this is one of the first ones that people mentioned, is where's the movie for The Stars My Destination? Well, that's very true. The Stars My Destination, originally published in 1956, is considered by many one of the best science fiction novels, if not the best science fiction novel of all times. Then there's The Demolished Man from 1952, the original title of which is Tiger, Tiger, taken from the William Blake poem. And, I am very proud. I've got my... autographed copy of that at home, you know, to Jim. We know the real title, and T-Y-T-L-E, don't we? Signed, Alfred Bester. I can tell a lot of Alfie's stories. He's he was a very special human being and a very special writer. And he wrote many great short stories. The one I am going to read for you this morning is undoubtedly one of his best. There are a few, especially that work on the radio. And he, by the way, this guy wrote a lot for radio. Now, I have a problem with a lot of my old tapes. My interviews with Alfred are among those that are on reel-to-reel tapes at my house that are awaiting restoration, a project that, in fact, there is hope that there may be a way to get this done in the not-too-distant future. And I'll tell you more about that if and when it starts happening. But among those, as I said, was Alfie reading The Men Who Murdered Mohammed. And out of respect for the fact that sooner or later, I hope to have his voice doing that story, I will do a different story. This one is a bona fide tour de force. This one requires a bit of attention in terms of, well, follow who the narrator is, follow what is going on. And I think that Yeah, I should look up what year this story was written. See if you can guess the name from the sound of my typing into the pewter here. And yes, I did spell that correctly. 1954. It was actually on television. I never saw that, never knew that. Murder in the Android. Now, this is not something by Apple, referring to a kind of a phone. The name of the story is Fondly Fahrenheit. And all I ask is pay attention to whether this story is first person, third person, or just totally nerds. Fondly Fahrenheit by Alfred Bester. He doesn't know which of us I am these days, but they know one truth. You must own nothing but yourself. You must make your own life, live your own life, and die your own death, or else you will die another's. The rice fields on Paragon 3 stretch for hundreds of miles, like checkerboard tundras, a blue and brown mosaic under a burning sky of orange. In the evening, clouds whip up like smoke, and the paddies rustle and murmur. A long line of men marched across the paddies the evening we escaped from Paragon 3. They were silent, armed, intent, a long rank of silhouetted statues looming against the smoking sky. Each man carried a gun. Each man wore a walkie-talkie belt pack, the speaker button in his ear, the microphone bud clipped to his throat, the glowing view screen strapped to his wrist like a green-eyed watch. The multitude of screens showed nothing but a multitude of individual paths through the paddies. The annunciators made no sound but the rustle and splash of steps. The men spoke infrequently in heavy grunts, all speaking to all. Nothing here. What is here? Jason's Fields. You're drifting too far west. Close in the line there. Anybody covered the Grimson paddy? Yeah, nothing. Well, she couldn't have walked this far. Could have been carried. Think she's alive? Well, why should she be dead? The slow refrain swept up and down the long line of beaters advancing toward the smoky sunset. The line of beaters wavered like a writhing snake, but never ceased its remorseless advance. 100 men spaced 50 feet apart. 5,000 feet of ominous search. 1 mile of angry determination stretching from east to west across a compass of heat. Evening fell. Each man lit his search lamp. The writhing snake was transformed into a necklace of wavering diamonds. Clear here, nothing. Nothing here. Nothing. What about the Allen paddies? Covering them now. Think we missed her? Maybe. We'll beat back and check. This is going to be an all-night job. Allen paddies clear. God damn, we've got to find her. We'll find her. Well, here she is. Sector 7. Tune in. The line stopped. The diamonds froze in the heat. There was silence. Each man gazed into the glowing green screen on his wrist, tuning to Sector 7. All tuned to one. All showed a small, nude figure awash in the muddy puddle of a paddy. Along the figure, an owner's stake of bronze red, Vandeleur. The ends of the line converged towards the Vandeleur field. The necklace turned into a cluster of stars. 100 men gathered around a small, nude body, a child, dead in a rice paddy. There was no water in her mouth. There were finger marks on her throat. Her innocent face was battered. Her body was torn. Clotted blood on her skin was crusted and hard. Dead 3-4 hours at least. Her mouth is dry. She wasn't drowned. Beaten to death. In the dark evening heat, the men swore softly. They picked up the body. One stopped the others and pointed to the child's fingernails. She had fought her murderer. Under the nails were particles of flesh and bright drops of scarlet blood, still liquid, still uncoagulated.
Well, that blood ought to be clotted, too.
Funny. No, not so funny. What kind of blood don't clot? Android. Well, it looks like she was killed by one. Vandeleur owns an android. Ah, she couldn't have been killed by an android. Well, that's android blood under her nails. The police better check. The police are going to prove that I'm right. But androids can't kill. That's android blood, ain't it? Androids can't kill. They're made that way. Well, it looks like one android was made wrong. Jesus. And the temperature that day registered 92.9 degrees gloriously Fahrenheit. So, there we were, aboard the Paragon Queen en route for Megastar 5, James Vandeleur and his android. James Vandeleur counted his money and wept. In the second-class cabin with him was his android, a magnificent synthetic creature with classic features and wide blue eyes. Raised on his forehead in a cameo of flesh were the letters M.A., indicating that he was one of the rare multiple-aptitude android, worth $57,000 on the current exchange. There we were, weeping and counting and calmly watching. 1600 dollars, Vandeleur wept. That's all? $1,600. My house was worth $10,000. The land was worth $5,000. There was furniture, cars, my paintings, etchings, my plane, and nothing to show for everything but $1,600. Christ! I leaped up from the table and turned on the android. I pulled a strap from one of the leather bags and beat the android. It didn't move. I must remind you, the android said, that I am worth $57,000 on the current exchange. I must warn you that you are endangering valuable property. You're a damn crazy machine! Vandeleur shouted. I am not a machine, the android answered. The robot is a machine. The android is a chemical creation of synthetic tissue. What got into you, Vandeleur cried. Why didn't you do it, damn you? He beat the android savagely. I must remind you that I cannot be punished, it said. The pleasure-pain syndrome is not incorporated in the android synthesis. Then why did you kill her? Vandeleur shouted. If it wasn't for kicks, why did... I must remind you, the android said, that the second-class cabins in these ships are not soundproofed. Vandeleur dropped the strap and stood panting, staring at the creature he owned. Why did you do it? Why did you kill her? I asked. I don't know, I answered. First, it was malicious mischief, small things, petty destruction. I should have known there was something wrong with you then. Androids can't destroy, they can't harm, they... There is no pleasure-pain syndrome incorporated in the android synthesis. And it got to arson, then serious destruction, then assault that engineer on Rigel, each time worse, each time we had to get down out faster. Now it's murder. Christ, what is the matter with you? What's happened? There are no self-check relays incorporated in the android brain. Each time we had to get out, it was a step downhill. Look at me in a second-class cabin. Me, James Pedalog Vandeleur. There was a time when my father was the wealthiest. Now $1,600 in the world. That's all I've got. And you, Christ damn you. Vandeleur raised the strap to beat the android again, then dropped it and collapsed on a berth, sobbing. At last, he pulled himself together. Instructions, he said. The multiple android responded at once. It arose and awaited orders. My name is now Valentine, James Valentine. I stopped off on Paragon 3 for only one day to transfer to this ship for Megastar 5. My occupation? Agent for one privately owned M.A. android, which is for hire. Purpose of visit? To settle on Megastar 5. Fix the papers. The android removed Vandeleur's passport and papers from a bag, got pen and ink, and sat down at the table. With an accurate, flawless hand, an accomplished hand that could draw, write, paint, carve, engrave, etch, photograph, design, create, and build, it meticulously forged new credentials for Vandeleur. Its owner watched me miserably. "Create and build," I muttered. "Now destroy. Oh, God. What am I going to do? Christ, if only I could get rid of you. If only I didn't have to live off of you, God. If only I'd inherited some guts instead of you." Dallas Brady was Megastar's leading jewelry designer. She was short, stocky, amoral, and a nymphomaniac. She hired Vandeleur's multiple aptitude android and put me to work in her shop. She seduced Vandeleur. In her bed one night, she asked abruptly, "Your name's Vandeleur, right?" "Yes," I muttered. "No, wait, no, it's Valentine. James Valentine." "What happened on Paragon?" Dallas Brady asked. "I thought androids couldn't kill or destroy property. Prime directives and inhibitions set up for them when they're synthesized. Every company guarantees they can't." "Valentine," Vandeleur insisted. "Oh, come off it," Dallas Brady said. "I've known for a week. I haven't collared copper, have I?" "The name is Valentine." "Oh, yeah? You want to prove it? You want I should call the cops?" Dallas reached out and picked up the phone. "Oh, for God's sakes, Dallas!" Vandeleur leaped up and struggled to take the phone from her. She fended him off, laughing at him until he collapsed and wept in shame and helplessness. "How did you find out?" he asked at last. "Oh, the papers are full of it. And Valentine was a little too close to Vandeleur. That wasn't smart, was it?" "I guess not. I'm not very smart. Your android's got quite a record, hasn't it? Assault, arson, destruction. What happened on Paragon?" "It kidnapped a child, took her out into the rice fields, and murdered her."
"Raped her?"
"I don't know." "They're going to catch up with you." "Don't I know it? Christ. We've been running for 2 years now. 7 planets in 2 years. I must have abandoned $50,000 worth of property in 2 years.
You better find out what's wrong with it."
"How can I? Can I walk into a repair clinic and, you know, ask for an overhaul? What am I going to say? My android just turned killer. Fix it." "They call the police right off." I began to shake. "They'd have that android dismantled inside one day, and I'd probably be booked as an accessory to murder."
"Why didn't you have it repaired before it got to murder?"
"I couldn't take the chance," Vandeleur explained angrily. "If they started fooling around with lobotomies and body chemistry and endocrine surgery, they might have destroyed its aptitudes. And then what would I have to hire out? How would I live?"
"You could work for yourself. People do."
"Work at what? You know I'm good for nothing. How can I compete with specialist androids and robots? I mean, who can unless you've got a terrific talent for a particular job?"
"Yeah, well, that's true.
I lived off my old man all my life. Damn him. He had to go bust just before he died. Left me the android. That's all. The only way I can get along is living off what it earns."
"You'd better sell it before the cops catch up with you. You can live off 50 grand. Invest it."
"At 3%? 1,500 a year? When the android returns 15% on its value? 8,000 a year? That's what it earns. No, Dallas. I've got to go along with it."
"Well, what are you going to do about its violence kick?"
"I can't do anything except watch it and pray."
"What are you going to do about it?"
"Well, nothing. It's none of my business. Only one thing.
I ought to get something for keeping my mouth shut."
"What?"
"That android works for me for free. Let somebody else pay you, but I get it for free."
The multiple aptitude android worked. Vandeleur collected its fees. His expenses were taken care of. His savings began to mount. As the warm spring of Megastar 5 turned to hot summer, I began investigating farms and properties. it would be possible within a year or two for us to settle down permanently, provided Dallas Brady's demands did not become rapacious. On the first day of summer, the android began singing in Dallas Brady's workshop. It hovered over the electric furnace, which, along with the weather, was broiling the shop, and sang an ancient tune that had been popular half a century before. Ah, it's no feat to beat the heat, all reet, so cheat your seat, be fleet, cool and discreet, honey. It sang in a strange, halting voice, and its accomplished fingers were clasped behind its back, writhing in a strange rumba all their own. Dallas Brady was surprised. Are you surprised or something? Are you happy or something? She asked. I must remind you that the pleasure pain synthesis syndrome is not incorporated in the android synthesis, I answered. All reet, be fleet, cool and discreet. Honey. Its fingers stopped their twisting and picked up a heavy pair of iron tongs. The android poked them into the glowing heart of the furnace, leaning far forward to peer into the lovely heat. Be careful, you damn fool, Dallas Brady explained. You want to fall in? I must remind you that I am worth 57,000 on the current exchange, I said. It is forbidden to endanger valuable property. All reet, honey. It withdrew a crucible of glowing gold from the electric furnace, turned, capered hideously, sang crazily, and splashed a sluggish gobbet of molten gold over Dallas Brady's head. She screamed and collapsed, her hair and clothes flaming, her skin crackling. The android poured again while it capered and sang, be fleet, cool and discreet, honey. It sang and slowly poured and poured the molten gold. Then I left the workshop and rejoined James Vandeleur in his hotel suite. The android's charred clothes and squirming fingers warned its owner that something was very much wrong. Vandeleur rushed to Dallas Brady's workshop, stared once, vomited, and fled. I had enough time to pack one bag and raise $900 on portable assets. He took a third-class cabin on the Megastar Queen, which left that morning for Lyra Alpha. He took me with him. He wept and counted his money, and I beat the android again. And the thermometer in Dallas Brady's workshop registered 98.1 degrees, beautifully Fahrenheit. On Lyra Alpha, we holed up in a small hotel near the university. There, Vandeleur carefully bruised my forehead until the letters M.A. were obliterated by the swelling and the discoloration. The letters would reappear again, but not for several months, and in the meantime, Vandeleur hoped that the hue and cry for an M.A. android would be forgotten. The android was hired out as a common laborer in the university power plant. Vandeleur, as James Venice, eked out life on the android's small earnings. I wasn't too unhappy. Most of the other residents in the hotel were university students, equally hard up but delightfully young and enthusiastic. There was one charming girl with sharp eyes and a quick mind. Her name was Wanda, and she and her beau, Jed Stark, took a tremendous interest in the killing android, which is being mentioned in every paper in the galaxy. We've been studying the case, she and Jed said at one of the casual student parties which happened to be held this night in Vandeleur's room. We think we know what's causing it. We're going to do a paper. They were in a very high state of excitement. Causing what? Somebody wanted to know. The android rampage. Well, it's obviously out of adjustment, isn't it? Body chemistry gone haywire. Like, you know, maybe a kind of synthetic cancer, yeah? No. Wanda gave Jed a look of suppressed triumph. Well, then, what is it? Something specific. What? That would be telling. Oh, come on. Nothing doing. Won't you tell us? I asked intently. We're very much interested in what could go wrong with an android. No, Mr. Venice, Wanda said. It's a unique idea, and we've got to protect it. One thesis like this, and we'll be set up for life. We can't take the chance of somebody stealing it. Ah, oh, can't you give us a hint? No, not a hint. Don't say a word, Jed. But I'll tell you this much, Mr. Venice. I'd hate to be the man who owns that android. What? You mean the police? I asked. I mean projection, Mr. Venice. Projection. That's the danger, and I won't say anything more. I've said too much as it is. I heard steps outside and a hoarse voice singing softly, be fleet, cool and discreet, honey. My android entered the room, home from its tour of duty at the university power plant. It was not introduced. I motioned to it, and I immediately responded to the command and went to the beer keg and took over Vandeleur's job of serving the guests. Its accomplished fingers writhed in a private Roomba of their own. Gradually, they stopped their squirming, and the strange humming ended. Androids were not unusual at the university. The wealthier students owned them along with cars and planes. Vandeleur's android provoked no comment, but young Wanda was sharp-eyed and quick-witted. She noted my bruised forehead, and she was intent on the history-making thesis that she and Jed Stark were going to write. After the party broke up, she consulted with Jed, walking upstairs to her room. Jed, why did that android have a bruised forehead? Well, it probably hurt itself, Wanda. It's working at the power plant. They fling a lot of heavy stuff around. That all? Well, what else? It could be a convenient bruise. Yeah, what convenient for what? Hiding what's stamped on its forehead. Aw, there's no point to that, Wanda. You don't have to see marks on a forehead to recognize an android. You don't have to see a trademark on a car to know that it's a car. I don't mean that it's trying to pass as a human. I mean it's trying to pass as a lower-grade android. Well, why? Suppose it had M.A. on its forehead. Multiple aptitude? Well, then why in the hell would Venice waste its stoking furnaces if it could earn... You mean that it's... Wanda nodded. Jesus! Stark pursed his lips. What do we do? Call the police? No, we don't know if it's an M.A. for a fact. If it turns out to be an M.A. and the killing android, our paper comes first anyway. This is our big chance, Jed. If it's that android, we can run a series of controlled tests. And how do we find out for sure? Easy. Infrared film. That's going to show us what's under the bruise. Borrow a camera, buy some film. We'll sneak down to the power plant tomorrow afternoon and take some pictures, and then we'll know. They stole down into the university power plant the following afternoon. It was a vast cellar, deep under the earth. It was dark, shadowy, luminous, with burning light from the furnace doors. Above the roar of the fires, they could hear a strange voice, shouting and chanting in the echoing vault. All reet, so jeet your seat, be fleet, cool and discreet, honey. And they could see a capering figure dancing a lunatic rumba in time to the music it shouted. The legs twisted, the arms waved, the fingers writhed. Jed Stark raised the camera and began shooting his spool of infrared film, aiming the camera sights at the bobbing head. Then Wanda shrieked, for I saw them and came charging down on them, brandishing a polished steel shovel. It smashed the camera, it felled the girl, and then the boy. Jed fought me for a desperate hissing moment before he was bludgeoned into helplessness. Then the android dragged them to the furnace and fed them to the flames. Slowly, hideously, it capered and sang. Then it returned to my hotel. The temperature in the power plant registered 100.9 degrees murderously Fahrenheit. All reet, all reet.
We bought Steerage and the Lyra Queen, and Vandeleur and the Android did odd jobs for their meals. During the night watches, Vandeleur would sit alone in the steerage head with a cardboard portfolio on his lap, puzzling over the contents. That portfolio was all that he had managed to bring with him from Lyra Alpha. He had stolen it from Wanda's room. It was labeled Android. It contained the secret of my sickness. And it contained nothing but newspapers. Scores of newspapers from all over the galaxy, printed, microfilmed, engraved, etched, offset, photostated, Riger Star Banner, the Paragon Picayune, Megastar Times Leader, Leland Herald, Lakyle Journal, Indie Intelligencer, Eridani Telegram News, all reet, nothing but newspapers. Each paper contained an account of one crime in the android's ghastly career. Each paper also contained news, domestic and foreign, sports, society, weather, shipping news, stock exchange quotations, human interest stories, features, contests, puzzles. Somewhere in that mass of uncollated facts was the secret Wanda and Jed Stark had discovered. Vandeleur pored over the papers helplessly. It was beyond him. So jeet your seat. I'll tell you, I told the android. I'll sell you. Damn you. Damn. When we land on Alpha, I'm going to sell you. I'll settle for 3% on whatever you're worth. I am worth $57,000 on the current exchange, I told him. If I can't sell you, I'll turn you into the police, I said. I am valuable property, I answered. It is forbidden to endanger valuable property. You won't have me destroyed. Christ! Damn you! Vandeleur cried. What? Are you arrogant? Do you know that you can trust me to protect you? Is that the secret? The multiple aptitude android regarded him with calm, accomplished eyes. Sometimes, it said, it is a good thing to be property. It was 3 below 0 when the Lyra Queen dropped at Croydon Field. A mixture of ice and snow swept across the field, fizzing and exploding into steam under the Queen's tail jets. The passengers trotted numbly across the blackened concrete to customs inspection, and thence to the airport bus that was to take them to London. Vandeleur and the android were broke. They walked. By midnight, they reached Piccadilly Circus. The December ice storm had not slackened, and the statue of Eros was encrusted with ice. They turned right, walked down to Trafalgar Square, and then along the Strand, shaking with cold and wet. Just above Fleet Street, Vandeleur saw a solitary figure coming from the direction of St. Paul's. He drew the android into an alley. "We have got to have money," he whispered. He pointed at the approaching figure. "Figure, he has money. Take it from him." "The order cannot be obeyed," the android said. "Take it from him," Vandeleur repeated. "By force, do you understand? We are desperate." "It is contrary to my prime directive," I said. "I cannot endanger life or property. The order cannot be obeyed."
"For Christ's sake," Vandeleur burst out. "You've attacked, destroyed, murdered. Don't gibber about prime directives. You don't have any. Get his money. Kill him if you have to. I'm telling you that we're desperate."
"It is contrary to my prime directive," I said. "I cannot endanger life or property. The order cannot be obeyed." I thrust the android back and leaped out at the stranger. He was tall, austere, competent. He had an air of hope curdled by cynicism. He carried a cane. I saw he was blind.
"Yes," he said. "I hear you near me. What is it?"
"Sir," Vandeleur hesitated.
I'm desperate." "We are all desperate," the stranger replied. "Quietly desperate, sir. I've got to have some money." "Are you begging or stealing?"
The sightless eyes passed over Vandeleur and the android.
"I am prepared for either. Ha ha ha. So are we all. It is the history of our race," the stranger motioned over his shoulder. "I have been begging at St. Paul's, my friend. What I desire cannot be stolen.
What is it you desire that you are lucky enough to be able to steal?
Money, Vandeleur said. Money for what? Oh, come, my friend, let us exchange confidences. I will tell you why I beg, if you will tell me why you steal. My name is Blenheim.
My name is Vole.
I was not begging for sight at St. Paul's, Mr. Vole. I was begging for a number.
A number?
Ah, yes. Numbers rational, numbers irrational, numbers imaginary, positive integers, negative integers, fractions, positive and negative, eh? You've never heard of Blenheim's immortal treatise on 20 zeros, or the differences in the absence of quantity? Blenheim smiled bitterly. I am the wizard of the theory of number, Mr. Vole, and I have exhausted the charm of number for myself. After 50 years of wizardry, senility approaches, and the appetite vanishes. I have been praying in St. Paul's for inspiration. Dear God, I prayed, if you exist, send me a number. Vandeleur slowly lifted the cardboard portfolio and touched Blenheim's hand in it. In here, he said, is a number, a hidden number, a secret number, the number of a crime. Shall we exchange, Mr. Blenheim, shelter for a number?
Neither begging or stealing, eh? Blenheim said, but a bargain. So, all life reduces itself to the banal.
Sightless eyes again passed over Vandeleur and the android. Perhaps the Almighty is not God, but a merchant. Come home with me.
On the top floor of Blenheim's house, we shared a room. Two beds, two closets, two washstands, one bathroom. Vandeleur bruised my forehead again and sent me out to find work. And while the android worked, I consulted with Blenheim and read him the papers from the portfolio, one by one. All reet. All reet. Vandeleur told him so much and no more. He was a student, I said, attempting a thesis on the murdering android. In these papers which he had collected were the facts that would explain the crimes of which Blenheim had heard nothing. There must be a correlation, a number, a statistic, something that would account for my derangement, I explained. And Blenheim was piqued by the mystery, the detective story, the human interest of number. We examined the papers. As I read them aloud, he listed them and their contents in his blind, meticulous writing. And then I read his notes to them. He listed the papers by type, by typeface, by fact, by fancy, by article, spelling, words, theme, advertising, pictures, subject, politics, prejudices. He analyzed. He studied. He meditated. And we lived together on that top floor, always a little bit cold, always a little terrified, always a little closer, brought together by our fear of it, our hatred between us, like a wedge driven into a living tree and splitting the trunk, only to be forever incorporated into the scar tissue. We grew together, Vandeleur and the android. Be fleet, be fleet. And one afternoon, Blenheim called Vandeleur into his study and displayed his notes. I think I found it, he said, but I can't understand it. Vandeleur's heart leaped. Here are the correlations, Blenheim continued. In 50 papers, there are accounts of the criminal android. What is there outside of the depredations that is also in the 50 papers?
I don't know, Mr. Blenheim. It was a rhetorical question. Here is the answer. The weather.
What?
The weather, Blenheim nodded. Each crime was committed on a day when the temperature was above 90 degrees Fahrenheit.
But that's impossible, Vandeleur exclaimed. It was cool on Lyra Alpha.
We have no record of any crime committed on Lyra Alpha. There is no paper. Yeah, that's right. I... Vandeleur was confused. Suddenly he exclaimed, "No! You're right, the furnace room. It was hot in there. Right, hot. Of course, my God, yes, that's the answer. Dallas Brady's electric furnace. The Rice Delta's on Paragon. So, gee, your seat. Yes, but why? Why, my God, why?" I came into the house at that moment, and passing the study, saw Vandeleur and Blenheim. I entered, awaiting commands, my multiple aptitudes devoted to service. "That's the android, eh?" Blenheim said after a long moment.
Yes,
Vandeleur answered, still confused by the discovery. "And that explains why it refused to attack you that night on the Strand. It wasn't hot enough to break the Prime Directive. Only in the heat, all reet." He looked at the android. A silent lunatic command passed from man to android. "I refused. It is forbidden to endanger life." Vandeleur gestured furiously, then seized Blenheim's shoulders and yanked him back out of his desk chair to the floor. Blenheim shouted once. Vandeleur leaped on him like a tiger, pinning him to the floor and sealing his mouth with one hand. "Find a weapon," he called to the android. "It is forbidden to endanger life." "There is a fight for self-preservation. Bring me a weapon." He held the squirming mathematician with all his weight. I went at once to a cupboard where I knew a revolver was kept. I checked it. It was loaded with 5 cartridges. I handed it to Vandeleur. I took it, rammed the barrel once against Blenheim's head, and pulled the trigger. He shuddered once. We had 3 hours before the cook returned from her day off. We looted the house. We took Blenheim's money and jewels. We packed a bag with clothes. We took Blenheim's notes, destroyed the newspapers, and we left, carefully locking the door behind us. In Blenheim's study, we left a pile of crumpled papers under a half inch of burning candle, and we soaked the rug around it with kerosene. No, I did all that. The android refused. I am forbidden to endanger life or property. All reet. They took the tubes to Leicester Square, changed trains, and rode to the British Museum. There they got off and went to the small Georgian house just off Russell Square. A shingle in the window read, "Nan Webb, Psychometric Consultant." Vandeleur had made a note of the address some weeks earlier. They went into the house. The android waited in the foyer with the bag. Vandeleur entered Nan Webb's office. She was a tall woman with gray shingled hair, very fine English complexion, and very bad English legs. Her features were blunt, her expression acute. She nodded to Vandeleur, finished a letter, sealed it, and looked up. "My name," I said, "is Vanderbilt. James Vanderbilt." Quite. "I'm an exchange student at London University." Quite. "I have been researching on the killing android, and I think I've discovered something very interesting, and I'd like your advice on it. What is your fee?" "What is your college at the university?" "Why, there's a discount for students." "Merton College. £2, please." Vandeleur placed £2 on the desk and added to the fee Blenheim's notes. "There is a correlation," he said, "between the crimes of the android and the weather. You will note that each crime was committed when the temperature rose above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Is there a psychometric answer for this?" Nan Webb nodded, studied the notes for a moment, put down the sheets of paper, and said, "Synesthesia, obviously." "What?" "Synesthesia," she repeated. "When a sensation, Mr. Vanderbilt, is interpreted immediately in terms of a sensation from a different sense organ than the one stimulated, it is called synesthesia. For example, a sound stimulus gives rise to a simultaneous sensation of definite color, or color gives rise to a sensation of taste, or a light stimulus gives rise to a sensation of sound.
There can be confusion or short-circuiting or any sensation of sound, smell, pain, pressure, temperature, and so on. Do you understand?
I think so.
Your research has uncovered the fact that the android most probably reacts to temperature stimulus above the 90-degree level synesthetically. Most probably there's an endocrine response, probably a temperature linkage with the android adrenal surrogate. High temperature brings about a response of fear, anger, excitement, and violent physical activity, all within the province of the adrenal gland.
I see. So if the android were kept in cold climate,
well, then there would be neither stimulus nor response. There would be no crimes. Quite.
I see. What is projection?
How do you mean?
Is there any danger of projection with regard to the owner of the android?
Oh. Interesting. Projection is a throwing forward. It is the process of throwing out upon another the ideas or impulses that belong to oneself. The paranoid, for example, projects upon others his conflicts and disturbances in order to externalize them. He accuses directly or by implication other men of having the very sickness with which he is struggling himself.
Okay, and the danger of projection?
It is the danger of believing what is implied. If you live with a psychotic who projects his sickness upon you, there is a danger of falling into a psychotic pattern and becoming virtually psychotic yourself, as, no doubt, is happening to you, Mr. Vandeleur.
Vandeleur leaped to his feet.
You are an ass, Nanweb went on crisply. She waved the sheets of notes. This is no exchange student's writing. This is the unique cursive of the famous Blenheim. Every scholar in England knows this blind writing. There is no Merton College at London University. That was a miserable guess. Merton is at Oxford. And you, Mr. Vandeleur, are so obviously infected by association with your deranged android, by projection, if you will, that I hesitate between calling the Metropolitan Police and the Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
I took out the gun and shot her. Reet! Antares 2, Alpha Aurigae, Eryx 4, Pollux 9, Rigel Centaurus, Vandeleur said. They're all cold, cold as a witch's kiss. Mean temperatures of 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Never gets hotter than 70. We're in business again. Watch that curve. The multiple aptitude android swung the wheel with its accomplished hands.
The car took the curve sweetly and sped on through the northern marshes, the reeds stretching for miles, brown and dry, under the cold English sky. The sun was sinking swiftly. Overhead, a lone flight of bustards flapped clumsily eastward. High above the flight, a lone helicopter drifted towards home and warmth.
No more warmth for us, I said. No more heat. We're safe when we're cold. We'll hole up in Scotland, make a little money, get across to Norway, build a bankroll, then ship out. We'll settle on Pollux. We're safe. We've licked it. We can live again.
There was a startling bleep from overhead and a ragged roar.
Attention, James Vandeleur and Android! Attention, James Vandeleur and Android!
Vandeleur started and looked up. The lone helicopter was floating above them. From its belly came amplified commands.
You are surrounded. The road is blocked. You are to stop your car at once and submit to arrest. Stop at once.
I looked at Vandeleur for orders.
Keep driving, Vandeleur snapped.
The helicopter dropped lower.
Attention, Android. You are in control of the vehicle. You are to stop at once. This is a state directive superseding all private commands.
What the hell are you doing? I shouted. A state directive supersedes all private commands, the android answered. I must point out to you that... Get away from the wheel, Vandeleur ordered. I clubbed the android, yanked him sideways, and squirmed over to the wheel. The car veered off the road in that moment and went churning through the frozen mud and dry reeds. Vandeleur regained control and continued westward through the marshes toward a parallel highway 5 miles distant. We'll beat their goddamn block, he grunted. The car pounded and surged. The helicopter dropped even lower. A searchlight blazed from the belly of the plane.
Attention, James Vandeleur and Android. Submit to arrest. This is a state directive superseding all private commands.
He can't submit, Vandeleur shouted wildly. There's no one to submit to. He can't and I won't.
Christ, I muttered, we'll beat them yet. We'll beat the block. We'll beat the heat. We'll... I must point out to you, they said, that I am required by prime directive to obey state directives which supersede all private commands. I must submit to arrest.
Well, who says it's a state directive, Vandeleur said? Them? What, up in that plane? They've got to show credentials. Yeah, they've got to prove it. You've got to know that it's state authority before you submit. How do you know that they're not crooks trying to trick us?
Holding the wheel with one arm, he reached into his side pocket to make sure the gun was still in place. The car skidded. The tire squealed on frost and reeds. The wheel was wrenched from his grasp, and the car yawed up a small hillock and overturned. The motor roared, and the wheels screamed. Vandeleur crawled out and dragged the android with him. For the moment, we were outside the circle of light boring down from the helicopter. We blundered off into the marsh, into the blackness, into concealment, Vandeleur running with a pounding heart, hauling the android along. The helicopter circled and soared over the wrecked car, searchlight peering, loudspeaker braying. On the highway we had left, lights appearing as the pursuing and blocking parties gathered and followed radio directions from the plane. Vandeleur and the android continued deeper and deeper into the marsh, working their way towards the parallel road and safety. It was night by now. The sky was a black mat. Not a star showed. The temperature was dropping. A southeast night wind knifed us to the bone. Far behind, there was a dull concussion. Vandeleur turned, gasping. The car's fuel had exploded. A geyser of flame shot up like a lurid fountain. It subsided into a low crater of burning reeds. Whipped by the wind, the distant hem of flame fanned up into a wall 10 feet high. The wall began marching down on us, cracking fiercely. Above it all, a pall of oil smoke surged forward. Behind it, Vandeleur could make out the figures of men, a mass of beaters searching the marsh. Christ! I cried, and searched desperately for safety. He ran, dragging me with him, until their feet crunched through the surface ice of a pool. He trampled the ice furiously, then flung himself down in the numbing water, pulling the android with us. The wall of flame approached. I could hear the crackle and feel the heat. He could see the searchers clearly. Vandeleur reached into his side pocket for the gun. The pocket was torn. The gun was gone. He groaned and shook with cold and terror. The light from the marsh fire was blinding. Overhead, the helicopter floated helplessly to one side, unable to fly through the flame and smoke and aid the searchers who were beating far to the right of us. They'll miss us, Vandeleur whispered. Keep quiet. That's an order. They'll miss us. We'll beat them. We'll beat the fire. Well, three distinct shots sounded less than 100 feet from the fugitives. Blam! 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 They came from the last three cartridges in my gun as the marsh fire reached it where it had dropped and exploded the shells. The searchers turned toward the sound and began working directly toward us. Vandeleur cursed hysterically and tried to submerge even deeper to escape the intolerable heat of the fire. The android began to twitch. The wall of flame surged up to them. Vandeleur took a deep breath and prepared to submerge until the flame passed over them. The android shuddered and burst into an ear-splitting scream. All right! All right! It shouted, B-Fleet! B-Fleet! Damn you! I shouted. I tried to drown it. Damn you! I cursed him. I smashed his face. The android battered Vandeleur, who fought it off until it exploded out of the mud and staggered upright. Before I could return to the attack, the live flames captured it hypnotically. It danced and capered in a lunatic rumba before the wall of fire. Its legs twisted, its arms waved. The fingers writhed in a private rumba of their own. It shrieked and sang and ran in a crooked waltz before the embrace of the heat, a muddy monster silhouetted against the brilliant, sparkling flare. The searchers shouted. There were shots. The android spun around twice and then continued its horrid dance before the face of the flames. There was a rising gust of wind. The fire swept around the capering figure and enveloped it for a roaring moment. Then the fire swept on, leaving behind it a sobbing mass of synthetic flesh, oozing scarlet blood that would never coagulate. The temperature would have registered 1,200 degrees, wondrously Fahrenheit. Vandeleur didn't die. I got away. They missed him while they watched the android caper and die, but I don't know which one of us he is these days. Projection, Wanda warned me. Projection, Nan Webb told him. If you live with a crazy man or a crazy machine long enough, I become crazy too. Reet! But we know one truth. We know they were wrong. The new robot and Vandeleur know that because the new robot has started twitching too. Reet! Here on Cold Pollux, the robot is twitching and singing. No heat, but my fingers writhe. No heat, but it's taking the little tally girl off for a solitary walk. A cheap labor robot, a servo mechanism. All I could afford, but it's twitching and humming and walking along with a child somewhere, and I cannot find them. Christ! Vandeleur can't find me before it's too late. It's cool and discreet, honey, in the dancing frost, while the temperature registers 10 degrees, fondly Fahrenheit. Fondly Fahrenheit by Alfie Bester. This, of course, is Ethel Waters.
Into town last week. She came from the island of Martinique. The can-can she dances will make you fry. The can-can is really the reason why we're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The temperature's rising, it isn't surprising. She certainly can. She started a heat wave by letting us feet wave. And in such a way that the customers say that she certainly can. She, her anatomy, made the mercury jump to 93. Yes, sir, we're having a heat wave. A tropical heat wave. The way that she moves that thermometer proves that she certainly can. It's so hot the weatherman will tell you a record's been made. It's so hot a coat of tan will cover your face in the shade. It's so hot the coldest maiden feels just as warm as a bride. It's so hot, a chicken laid an egg on the street and it fried. We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The temperature's rising, it isn't surprising. She certainly can. She started a heat wave by letting her seat wave. And in such a way that the customers say that she certainly can. Gee. heart anatomy. Made that Mercury jump to 93. Yeah, man, we're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The way that she moves, that thermometer proves that she certainly can.
Yeah, can you? Oh, God, Irving Berlin. Lister and I were figuring out Irving Berlin, but that was the great, the one, the unique Ethel Waters. Nobody like her. I mean, yes, you can say that about Ella Fitzgerald. Yes, you can say that about a couple of others, but this is Ethel Waters. I love Ethel Waters. And that story, Fondly Fahrenheit, huh? How about that? As mentioned, Alfred Bester was the author of that story, written in about 1951, 52, published in 52. I mean, let's do the math. 60-something years old, that story. 61 and a half years ago is that story. And as Lister said, it could have been written yesterday and people would go, ooh, nice trick. I mean, the whole thing with the first person, the third person, the second person going throughout, is the whole thing on projection. You, at first, it's merely confusing. That you wait, hey, wait a second. Before, when he used the first person singular, I, it was Vandalore, then it was the android, then we're in the omniscient narrator who's talking about these other characters, and that probably is the voice of Alfred Bester, but then we're back to that entire back and forth projection. And what is the end of that story? What is that about? That now he's got an ordinary cheap labor robot and it's killing? No, not that's not my interpretation. My interpretation is that the killer by that time is totally Vandalore. That it's, you know, this is just a cheapo robot. And it doesn't have the capability. And by the way, it's a robot, not an android. The one before is an android, which means that it's synthetic and has to obey certain orders. A robot is, you know, just a cheap labor device. It's a mechanical thing like a car. At least that's the implication within the story. So what, at 10 degrees fondly Fahrenheit, is going on there? My answer, my interpretation, it's Vandalore is finally the killer. I mean, starts with the android, probably, but not always necessarily. We don't always know who the killer is. When you reread the story over and over, you sort of get the sense, okay, it's Vandalore who kills Blenheim, who kills the blind mathematician. It's the robot that kills and possibly has raped the little girl just before the story opens up, when all these people are beating the marshes trying to get it. It nevertheless remains a tour de force. There was a television version I saw looking it up online, and it's like, who cares? This is not, I don't think even a radio version would do this properly, because where do the voices come in and go out? Who is speaking when? If you change any of the words that are Alfred Bester's words, you are losing the impact and critical twist that the story is providing, that first third person psychotic. By the way, if you'd like to call up and discuss the story, telephone number here, WBAI New York, is 212-209-2900. And you must be on topic. It must be about the story. If it's about anything else, whether it's Ethel Waters or whatever, no, you're just being hung up on. Yes, well, we'll get near a microphone if you've got a question. Yes, caller. What is your question, Mr. Lister?
My question is, where did they come up with the word Android? It is from NAND gate or AND gate or...
You know, I'm actually not sure. I know that... Robot is from Czech. It's from Karl Čapek's Rossum's Universal Robots, R-U-R, is the name of a play that he wrote, which is a play written in the 1920s, very Art Deco political satire. Mm-hmm. Android, I'm really not sure about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let me take a look.
Android.
Yeah.
Is it from Nangate or Angate or?
I don't know. Let's
Android.
Let's give that a look. Yeah, if I type in Android, I'm going to get all these ads for phones.
Droid.
But let's actually.
I know it's not from steroids.
No, it would be, well, the and, of course, is like androgyne, and it means male.
Yeah.
You know, start with that. It's referring to a male. So let's see what we've got here. Android, and a robot with a human appearance. Synonyms, robot, automaton, cyborg, droid. No.
They're way wrong. Before
oh,
that.
But here is the origin. Ander in... Greek is man.
Oh.
And in modern Latin, androidus.
Yes.
Is also man. So in English, you
Andronymous.
Would add
Andronymous.
Andronymous.
Yeah, I got it.
So, and that from the early 18th century, apparently, is android.
18th century.
Yeah, which is really from the Greek, ander and man. Oid, you know, that's what we have offhand, and that's, of course, to coming out of a Google search, Google owning the Android operating system. So who the
you got a call? You F got knows. A call?
Yeah, we got a couple of calls. Right. Let's see what they have to say for themselves. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
1727, the Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary says, from that was published in 1991, so there might be an update on it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that about Android. And when you said nevertheless a tour de force, it's not nevertheless. But if you'll indulge a little speculation on it, I think the point was that we can't know by late in the story when it's Vandalur and when it's the Android, because neither of them knows either way.
Yeah.
They don't know, and we can't know either, because we're being told by them.
Yeah, that's quite true. We are being told by them. And let's say it's an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
Unreliable at the least. Not only unreliable, but murderous.
And psychotic.
And reliable. Totally psychotic, yes. I have friends like that.
No,
not you, Gary.
This time.
No, yeah. But, you see, darn, I got a tweet, and now, you know, deep in the bowels of this building, my Android first showed it to me. And it was also something, I think it was commenting on you saying 1751, indeed. I don't know if he was being, if you were being sarcastic or not. Do me a favor, because my phone is receiving, but I can't get to the app itself. Resend that, I don't know if it was tweet or from Facebook, but whatever it was, just resend it. And maybe this time the phone will actually display it for me.
Are you talking to me?
No. I'm talking to the fellow who just sent me something online.
Ah. I see.
Yeah, we have all these technologies. It comes from a person whose initials are JC. I'll say his first name is James, you know, but I don't want to give his name on the air without permission. So, well, we'll see if he retweets it or whatever it was. I, you know, given my Android, I don't know
it being an unreliable narrator in this case. I don't know whether it was Facebook or Twitter.
I myself can't go near either of those, but that was pretty much all I have to say. You got any other calls?
Yes.
Okay, I'll see you later.
Okay, take care. Have a good morning. All righty, and hi there. Oops. WBAI, you're on the radio.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, it's really funny because I really enjoyed your reading of that novel. And I have an interjection into that situation in terms of the whole phenomenon of transhumanism. And are you familiar with that term?
No, I'm not.
Well, you should be, because it's a terminology that is actually, it's active right now, and what it means. Have you heard of the movie Her?
I'm a huge fan of it, and we did a show on it 2 weeks ago,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, are you aware of that? Her is an acronym.
I don't believe it is.
Well, I know it is.
Okay, except that I don't think that Spike Jonze thinks it is, and he wrote it.
Well, it doesn't matter whether Spike Jonze...
Yeah, I think it does matter if the author knows it or not.
Okay, it stands for Human Enhancement Research.
Oh, I think they may mention that in the movie.
Okay,
that is possible.
They mention it.
Okay, but it isn't an acronym in real life. It's within the fiction.
What I'm saying is the thing about people who involve themselves with science fiction is that they think that science fiction is a part of an sort of like an it's outside of the realm of our actual political societal situation.
I don't believe that we believe that at all.
Listen, I was just watching Fahrenheit 451 the other day.
Okay.
Made in 1966.
Yes, by Francois Truffaut.
Okay, and there was a flat screen television in that movie.
Yes.
Okay, and there's another movie.
But that's an extremely political film, wouldn't you say?
Of course it is.
Okay, but you're saying that...
It's science fiction, and it just as a genre is extremely political.
Yes, it is. I thought you were saying that we were outside the political thinking.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
That there's a when people speak of it, and maybe even you, and that's what I'm approaching the situation from that standpoint, that there is a kind of fantasy element that's attached to it, like, oh, this is just something to stretch your imagination. And
oh, I mean no, we don't believe that at all. I mean, especially on a radio show that's been on the air now for 42 years about science fiction, I don't think we've ever posited that.
Okay. Well, whether you have or we in the larger part of your listening audience have done that, I don't know. What I'm saying is what I've heard from what you just recited, that the whole element of the author making that between the robot, the android, and the actual human element in the situation is sort of like a fluid, it's a flux situation.
In this case, it's about psychosis or projection,
psychosis,
as he says. Yes.
Yes, it's a psychosis.
That's what the story is about. By the way, I'm out of time.
Huh?
I'm sorry to say I'm out of time. My show is over.
Oh, I'm sorry to say that you are out of time.
Yeah, it's 2:56, really, and I have to start my outro music now.
Okay, that's really what it's about. And as long as people keep thinking this is a fantasy, that they're going to be on the receiving end of this situation.
Well, it's fiction is what it is. That's one of the...
No, it's not fiction. It's fictionalized.
No, it's fiction. It's a story.
And
that's where we have to make that distinction.
Okay.
Otherwise, we're involved in projection.
I'm going to ask you a question, though. Is what you consider fiction, okay, a product of the imagination or a product of the imagination reacting to what is already being...
What you just heard was a product of the imagination of Alfred Bester.
No, it's not.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry if you, you know, I can see that you've got something bigger to say, but our show is over, and I'm terribly sorry. But yes, it is. It's a story, a fiction story. That was written by the great Alfred Bester, born 100 years and 1 month ago. So, happy birthday, Alfie. I'm sorry you're not with us anymore, but that is, alas, the doom of mortality. This program is now, between this week and next, 42 years old, if you can believe it. Our guest next week on Hour of the Wolf will be Nancy Hightower. She's a brilliant writer. So please do tune in and join us then. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way to these airwaves shortly. Have a wonderful week and try to stay warm. It's all REIT.
And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the bitch.
The red part of the blue will spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
spaceship. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. You flag America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
la wa wa ha ha ha. Don't you cut off your dreadlocks? Let it go Don't you cut off your dreadlocks? Let it go till it reach your toes. Samson was a dreadlock, but he played a fool. Samson was a dreadlock, so Delilah betrayed. Don't you cut off your dreadlocks, because Georgia will chastise you. He will hurt you. Don't you cut off your dreadlocks. Let it go, let it go. That dreadlocks man is an evil man. But let me tell you something, dreadlocks man is a righteous man. So don't you cut off your dreadlocks. Let it go, oh, oh. Don't you do it, my brother. Let it go, oh. Whoa, 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 dreadlocks, man. Don't you cut off your dreadlocks. Let it go. Let it go all through your life, my brother. My brother. Sit down to cut off your natty dread. Let it go, Rasta man. Let it flow till it flow on. Jaja say, Jaja say, hey. Wah 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 ha ha ha. Jaja zang, Jaja zong, hey. Jaja hong, mama long, hey. Jaja long, mama long, hey. I said, don't you cut off your dreadlocks. Let it go, Rasta man.
The gift of Jah is eternal life. Still dumb, but my friends don't take the barber's knife. Everyone going around saying they know who shot the barber. I know who shot the barber. It was Stomp Dumb, the barber's son. I didn't say.
My dream last night was about Alibaba.
Stomp Dumb, the barber's son. Shot the barber, away he ran. He ran away, as I would say. And I'm not too ready to hide, for everyone know that everywhere you go, you hear people say, Tom shot the barber. Over there you hear they say, Tom shot the barber. The young know that, the old know that, everyone know that they say, Tom shot the barber. Him shot the barber. 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 He pulled the 38 from his waist last night.